All right. I think we're supposed to be finishing up economics in our three-day sprint, as it were. I should tell you, by the way, you may remember that Monday I was complaining about the weather and pointing out the implied warranty on the South Bay. I hadn't appreciated just how powerful illegal methods are. By the time I got out of the building, the sky was blue and the sun was shining. And this is the virtue of having a putative tort defendants who are not only omniscient but omnipresent. Anyway, so, but I'm not sure if it's going to stay that way or not. We'll see. So what have we covered so far? I sort of started out by explaining what I thought economics was, namely a way of understanding behavior based on the assumption that the predictable element in behavior is the tendency to take the actions that best achieve your objectives. I went on to talk about the coordination problem, the fact that with any large society you've got to find some way of coordinating people's efforts, since anything worth doing almost takes a bunch of people eventually to do it, and that one solution is central control, which works pretty well on small groups but has real problems on large groups, and another solution was some centralized mechanism somehow set up so that each person acting to achieve his objectives best coordinates or well coordinates with the rest. And the basic logic of that is that the price system transmits costs and values, that essentially the price I'm willing to sell goods at in a market is a measure of all of the costs of me producing them. Some of those costs are prices I have to pay to other people, which measure the cost to them. This is very much a superficial explanation of a much more elaborate point. The basic argument is that the way the price system works, cost of production gets passed through the chain so that when a firm sees that it costs it $18,000 to build an automobile, that $18,000 is ultimately the sum of the cost to the worker here of giving up a certain amount of time, the cost of using some iron that could have been used for something else for this purpose, and so forth. That thus prices on the market are a measure, not a perfect measure. There are various ways in which, one of which we'll be discussing briefly in a few minutes, there are various ways in which the price might overstate or understate the value, but it is a measure of it, and thus a whole lot better than nothing, a whole lot better than your guess, let's say, what cars ought to sell for. And going in the other direction, the fact that I can sell some final good to you at a price is evidence that you value it that much. So if you think of sort of that the, in a certain sense, that the efficient system is one where everything is produced that's worth producing, what does worth producing mean? It means the guy who eventually gets it is at least as great as the sum cost to all the people who have to produce it. That's a sort of a simple sense. Well, if I can sell it for at least as much as my costs, it's going to pay me to do so, and therefore the market system, to some approximation, will give you the right outcome. And then the complications in that basically come from reasons why the price might not accurately measure a cost, why what somebody's willing to pay might not accurately measure a value, and so forth. A whole bunch of complications in that system, but you're sort of starting with the simple story and then going up from that, if that makes sense. Sort of like if any of you have done physics, it's like doing your mechanics initially with frictionless billiard balls and figuring out what would happen with them and then putting in friction and air resistance and a bunch of other stuff. Frictionless billiard balls with perfectly elastic collisions, probably doing it that way. So I then sketched out, I talked a bit about the ways you could apply economics outside of what's normally thought of as economics by non-economists, and such as the economics of political institutions, the economics of marriage, economics of almost anything. And I then sketched the perfect competition model, which is sort of the simplified model which we can solve and gives clean, neat answers, and then was going on. And in that model, I explained about demand and supply curves and about consumer and producer surplus, which are in the book properly as they should be, because they give you a tool by which you can answer the question, does this change make the world better or worse? Now, it's better or worse in a particular imperfect, again, sense, but again, a good deal better than nothing. So that you can, in fact, sort of mathematically show that in this simplified world, imposing a tariff on the import of autos hurts Americans. And that's interesting because the standard, as far as I can tell, the standard view of the tariff controversy by everybody except economists is that when we impose a tariff, we help ourselves at the expense of our trading partners. And the only reason not to do it is we're afraid they'll retaliate by imposing a tariff on us. That's just wrong. The standard economic argument says if the other will do nothing at all, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. And why do we have tariffs? Because the economics of politics tells us that the political desires of concentrated and well-organized interest groups have much more weight than the desires of dispersed and disorganized interest groups. That if you've got some policy which benefits six people by $50 million, they can probably get together and offer at least $15 million in campaign contributions to get it. Whereas if it hurts 10,000 people by $50 million, they're not going to be able to raise nearly as much. Yep.
Is there any time that economists is happy with
tariffs? Yeah. There are a number of arguments. As I was saying before about the fact that you have a first approximation and then. First, if you're only concerned with the welfare of your own country, there are circumstances in which a tariff benefits your country in the same sense that a monopoly benefits monopoly producers at the expense of the customers. So imagine a case where we are what's called a monopsony, meaning a buying monopoly. Suppose we were the only country in the world that bought Japanese cars. Then putting on a tariff on importing Japanese cars makes them more expensive in the U.S. Making them more expensive in the U.S. means we buy fewer. That means that the demand for, that the quantity of Japanese cars demanded goes down, which lowers the price. Right? The Japanese car companies are competing with each other to sell cars, and we're buying fewer because of the tariff. That lowering of the price is a transfer from Japanese sellers to American buyers. So you can set up a situation in which a tariff acts as if the American buyers had all gotten together like a cartel and said, look, we'll all buy fewer cars. That'll drive down the price, and while we'd rather have more cars, we'd even more rather have a bit fewer cars at a lower price.
Why doesn't that work if there's no monopsony?
If there's no monopsony, if there's no... We're talking now about a monopsony, not of a single firm, but of a country. And the answer is that if you've got a competitive auto market, then U.S. demand does not have a significant effect on world prices, basically. That's the argument. The standard argument for tariffs is the so-called infant industry argument. And what that argument really says is, suppose there is some industry which the U.S. could do very well in if it was once established. And in the process of establishing it, firm A, in losing money while initially developing the industry, is partly producing benefits to firm B, C, and D, because they're training up people on how to do this who can be hired away. They're generating information on how best to produce this good in the U.S., which can be observed and copied and so forth. So the argument then is that rather than the normal market case where when a firm makes an investment, it gets the return from the investment, this is the case where when each firm makes the investment, other firms get a good deal of the return. Therefore, the firms have too low an incentive to make that investment. And then the argument is that you put on a tariff, now that makes producing this product profitable enough so that in spite of that you're willing to do it. And then the theory is that after a few years the industry gets established, you can drop the tariff and you're fine. And that, I do not know of any historical example of that ever happening. But it's not an incoherent theory, so to speak. But if you think about the fact that we have tariffs on steel and autos, all right, these are industries where the U.S. was, a pioneer, roughly 100 years ago now. So they're not infant industries. And indeed, there are economic reasons to think that you will tend to get tariffs on senile industries, not on infant industries. I can go into that in more detail, but there are reasons why a declining industry has more reason to buy a tariff than a growing industry. But anyway, if you're curious, we'll talk about off salary or something. It's an interesting point, but I think it goes beyond what I want to try to cover here. But those are sort of two arguments. The monopsony one is the one which is good economics. They're both good economics in a sense. It's just the latter one depends on special circumstances, and they're very unlikely to occur because the infant industry doesn't have any votes, whereas the senile industry does. So in any case, right. So as I say, the producer and consumer surplus give you a way of saying what's the net benefit or net cost to Americans, producers and consumers, if some change, such as a tariff. And I then went on to discuss a bit price control, which is what happens when you prices are not free to move, right? The normal situation, I suppose I should have done the standard here section. Probably at some point you'll see it. And that's when you have both a supply and a demand curve. I did do that implicitly. Here's the demand curve for something. Here's the supply curve. If the price were up here, we would observe the consumers wanted to buy less than the producers wanted to produce, so the producers are competing against each other and drive the price down. If the price were down here, you would observe that the consumers wanted to buy more than producers wanted to produce, so prices would get driven up. So that suggests that the market price would be where those two curves intersect. And then if one of the curves shifts, if the product becomes more popular, so the demand curve shifts out like that, then the price goes up like that. Right. Similarly, if supply curve shifts. Notice, by the way, that one implication of this is that you can't normally observe demand and supply curves, that they're tools for analyzing the situation. The reason you can't observe it is that when you actually observe our prices, but you don't know a priori what caused the change in prices. So if you knew, maybe you could imagine a case where you say, I'm sure the conditions determining the supply curve haven't changed. That industry has been the same for 50 years. But the following reasons are why the demand curve went up and down. You could then say, well, all right, the various demand curves, their intersections trace out the supply curve. All right? But unless you know that, you don't know whether the reason the price was different here was that the demand curve moved that way, or that the supply curve moved that way, which would again give you the same price, different quantity in that case, but you could imagine other shifts. So it's not as if economists are normally looking at demand and supply curves. Sometimes people try to estimate them for one reason or not. But mainly they're tools for analyzing the logic of something. All right? All right, so I ran through briefly the what to me is the interesting price control case, namely showing why in the simple case without any kind of rationing, what you end up with is actually making everybody worse off, even though it seems not to, because it results in the real cost of gasoline going up, not down, if you include waiting in lines. And that, again, is an oversimplification, because, of course, consumers aren't all identical. You could imagine that you are a consumer who doesn't mind waiting in lines. You're retired. You can sit in your book, sit in your car reading a good book or something. Other people, it's much more costly. So therefore, the amount of time that's $2 a gallon to them is 5 cents a gallon to you. So you're really getting a good deal. But then somebody else is getting a bad deal as a result in that case. Anyway, I talked a little bit about the questions of government regulation, mainly because I think the book gets it wrong. That is, the book accepts what I think was the sort of orthodox economic model about 50 years ago, namely that you think of governments as philosopher kings. You think of the government agency as it has this desirable purpose. It does its best to achieve that purpose. Sometimes it's hard to do and it fails, but that's the basic logic. Whereas what happened after that was public choice. Well, two things happened. One of them was public choice theory, which was the attempt to apply economics to political institutions, what I was just doing when I was talking about concentrated and dispersed interests, in which rather than assuming that congressmen are out to do good, I am assuming, roughly speaking, that congressmen are out to sell legislation to the highest bidder. And that's obviously an oversimplification, because it's not just money, it's also votes and various other things, but it's closer than just saying they decide what's good and do it. Somebody was just pointing out on something I was reading online that Newt Gingrich was in favor of the U.S. intervening in Libya until Obama did it and then decided it was a bad idea. I didn't check the quote, so maybe it wasn't true, but that was at least the claim, and it seemed plausible enough to me. It describes the real-world political behavior. And similarly, of course, Mitt Romney was all in favor of Obamacare when he was inventing it in Massachusetts, but is somewhat less in favor of it if he wants to get the Republican nomination for president to run against Obama. But anyway, the basic point I'm making is that you can replace the philosopher king model with some attempt at a realistic model in which we think of people in the political system as just like people in the economy, that each individual is trying to achieve his own objectives, he's taking the actions that best achieve them. If you're the president of a steel firm, part of that is lobbying for steel tariffs. And if you're a Detroit congressman, part of that is voting for auto tariffs and so forth. And on that model, you then, the other thing that happened, one of the things that happened was the development of public choice theory by Buchanan and Tulloch and other people applying economics to politics. The other was the development, especially by George Stigler, of looking at how regulation actually worked rather than what it said it did. And that generated what's referred to as the capture theory of regulation, which is that the typical pattern is that the regulatory agency comes under the control of the regulated industry, which then uses the regulation for its own purpose. So that, for example, you had regulation of the airlines by the Civil Aeronautics Board. Under that regulation, an airline that wanted to fly a new route required permission. And, of course, when they applied for permission, the airlines already flying that route would do their best to persuade the CAB they shouldn't get it because they didn't want the competition. Similarly, an airline that wanted to cut its fares required CAB permission, and, of course, the other airlines were not in favor of its cutting fares. So, and there were a whole bunch, I mean, we go into that much greater length. But basically what Stigler, I think, showed was that it was at least a common pattern that what the regulatory agency was actually doing was not trying to achieve the public interested objective that its charter said it was supposed to be doing, but trying to protect the regulated industry from competition of one sort or another. Yeah, it'd be a long story, and I really was saying I wanted to point that out mostly because I thought the book got that wrong. I was then starting to talk about monopoly last time, and that monopoly is basically a situation where one firm controls controls almost all the production of some particular market, makes all of the cars or all of the computers or something. And I discussed several reasons that would occur. One of them is the choke point. If you happen to have the essential patent or to own the one pass through the mountains or something like that. One of the two most important is economies of scale. If you happen to be in a case where a larger firm can produce cheaper than a smaller firm, which is especially likely if you have a small market, and therefore smaller, larger still isn't very large. It might still be the CEO is, you know, working on the assembly line at least part of the time. If you think about, let us say, writing books or software, where once you've written the book, that's a fixed cost. You can then produce as many copies as you like, and therefore there's a natural economy of scale there. So economies of scale tend to generate monopoly if they go far enough. That's natural monopoly. There is then the idea of artificial monopoly, the idea that a firm with no advantage could somehow drive all the other firms out of business. I think that's not as plausible as a lot of people think, for reasons I sketched, that basically when the large firm cuts below cost, it's losing more money than the small firm because it's selling more. Then there's the other important case besides natural monopoly, and that's state-enforced monopoly. So it's illegal for a private firm to compete with the post office. It's illegal to cut hair in Chicago until you've gotten a license, and the licenses are made difficult to get, thus keeping up the wages of barbers in Chicago, and lots of other examples. And, of course, patents. I'm not going to raise the question if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but obviously a patent is a government-granted monopoly of a sort. It's just copyright. And then what's wrong with monopoly? And from the economist standpoint, the sort of standard argument, you can go beyond it, is that the problem is that a monopoly, unlike a competitive firm, is not selling at marginal cost of production. That the competitive industry, as long as I can produce one more widget at a cost to me less than the price it pays me to do that, because I'll be making money on that extra widget. And in a competitive industry, the fact that the extra widget pushes prices down doesn't matter because I'm such a small part of the market that I can ignore it. And so in a competitive industry, everything is being sold, perfectly competitive industry, everything is being sold at a price equal to the cost of producing one more. And that's the efficient answer, because that means that anybody who values it at least what it costs to produce that extra unit gets it, and everybody who values it less doesn't. All right. Monopoly, that's not true. The monopolist correctly sees that if he was selling at marginal cost and if he raised his price a bit, he could still sell. He would sell somewhat less, but he'd be making more money per unit, and it then works out that there's a profit-maximizing price for the monopolist, normally above marginal cost, which means that there will be some people who aren't getting the good who value it at more than it would cost the monopolist to produce it, and nonetheless aren't getting it because they valued it less than the monopolist charges for it. So if you think of the prices as a signaling system, in effect, the monopoly seller is mis-signaling the real cost of his product. He's charging a price which is higher than the real cost of production, and the result is that everybody else, that people, if aluminum is a monopoly, people will substitute steel for aluminum, even when in terms of real cost it will be cheaper to use aluminum. Consumers will use cast iron pots instead of aluminum pots, even when in terms of the actual cost of making the two, the aluminum is cheaper, and so forth. Make arguments simple enough? I think that's as much detail as I really need to go in, given our time constraints. And so now there's a second potential inefficiency, which is really a later part of the literature on this, and this is what we refer to as rent seeking. Rent seeking is when I spend resources not to produce something, but in order that I, rather than somebody else, has something. And it's a useful concept. One of them, maybe I get to it later in law and econ, but one interesting question is, what's wrong with theft from the standpoint of the economist? Because after all, the economist might say, well, look, you stole $50 from me, I'm $50 worse off, you're $50 better off, looks like a wash to me if we care about everybody. And the economist's answer to that is, the ability to pick pockets means that you have an incentive to spend resources picking pockets, to compete with other pickpockets, to find the right people, to be skilled at it, and so forth. Those resources are spent transferring income from the victim to you, but the time and effort you spend doing it is a sheer waste, and therefore makes the society poorer as a whole. Probably get into a version of that, I suspect, next week, maybe. But the basic point, in the monopoly case, if there's monopoly profit to be made, my standard example is to imagine that somewhere out west that we're settling in, there is a valley. And the nature of this valley is such that one can predict that eventually it's going to pay to run a railroad line into that valley. But it'll never pay to run two lines in. All right, one line will carry everything. And you're a railroad entrepreneur, and so you're thinking about buying some land. Suppose the land was for sale, actually, in practice. It's homesteaded often. But you're thinking about constructing a railroad here, and the question is, when should you construct it? And you say, well, look, in 1900, I constructed in 1900, that will maximize my profit. Before then, the amount of business as this land is gradually settled isn't going to be enough to pay the expenses of running the railroad and maintaining the track and such. But after 1900, so I should build it in 1900. So what do you think happens when I show up in 1900 to look at the land to figure out how to build the railroad? Notice that if I build it in 1900, it's going to be a monopoly. I'm going to get monopoly profits. So if I build it in 1900, after paying all costs, I'm going to end up, over the lifetime of the railroad, $10 million to the good. Above all costs, including interest on my investment and everything else. So when I show up in 1900, what do I find? I'm not the only person in the world who knows how to build railroads. I'm not the only person in the world who can do this arithmetic. What do I find when I show up in 1900? Yep.
So then you're assuming that there's other suppliers with the same idea, and then they work back and they say, well, if they build in 1899, and then it goes back.
You got it. And so assuming that there are lots of people in the same situation, we're going to dissipate the whole $10 million. Because as long as the time someone is planning to build the railroad is late enough so there's still some monopoly profit left, it pays someone else to build it. That's what's referred to as complete dissipation in rent seeking. That's the analogous argument for theft is if we assume that there are lots of people equally talented at picking pockets. The more people are picking pockets, the less profitable it is, because first, some of the pockets are empty because someone else picked it first, and people are being more careful about what they carry and so forth. So people enter the business of being pickpockets until they've driven the wage from pickpocketing. Wage, so to speak, the earnings of pickpocketing, down to what they could make at McDonald's instead. But that means that the total amount stolen is being dissipated because that's the cost of diverting their labor from productive activity at McDonald's to unproductive activity, picking pockets. So it's the same logic as this. And in fact, if you went back to my price control gas station lines, this really isn't, if you think it through, that's a very simple. So anyway, so you dissipate. So that's what's referred to as rent-seeking. And Gordon Tullock, who was one of the people who invented public choice and who's a crazy, interesting guy, now pretty old, unfortunately, published an article which pointed out, the article was called The Welfare Costs of Tariffs, Monopoly, and Theft. It was about rent-seeking, and the basic argument was that monopolies have a larger cost than the conventional argument showed because there's the additional dissipation of monopoly profit by competing to be the first one there so that you get the monopoly before someone else arrives to take it. And similarly, he argued that tariffs have a larger cost than conventionally calculated because there's also the cost of the money spent getting the tariff, spent lobbying for the tariff, which is analogous to this, competing to get companies to do things, and theft, the argument I just made. It's a sort of classic article that's not as well known as it should be. So what do you do about monopoly? There it's not at all clear. Take the case of natural monopoly, which is the one where you don't really have the option of breaking it up and having a competitive industry because the small firms can't produce as cheaply as the large firms. If you stop, would force them to be small, you'd be raising your cost of production, which is may well be worse than having a monopoly. You don't know that. But if you just broke them up and then left it pretty soon, the most successful one would start growing and you'd end up with your monopoly again. So what can you do? And one possibility is to have a government-run monopoly like the post office. Technically, I think it's now private, but it's partly public now, and it certainly was public for a very long time. And in theory, the economist says you have your public monopoly, and you sell your good at marginal cost, or the cost of producing one more. We now get the efficient outcome. Now, first, since for a monopoly, because cost is falling as size expands, your marginal cost is probably below your average cost that you you imagine a firm where the reason is a natural monopoly is there's a big fixed cost, like designing software program, small marginal cost of producing more, sell at marginal cost, you never recover your fixed cost. So in order to have a government monopoly do that, it would have to have some source of revenue, presumably taxes to pay its losses. An alternative, and the alternative that regulation usually aims at, is to sell at average cost, and that way that's less than the optimal arrangement from the economist standpoint, but still better than what the monopolist is going to want to do because at average cost they'd have no profit. All right, if price equals average cost, that means your revenue just equals your cost. But the further problem, of course, is that all of this is again assuming the philosopher king model of government, and the real question would be what is it in the political interest of the people running the government monopoly to do, and that's not at all clear. It might be to charge monopoly prices in order to have a source of revenue for the government, which is what some, at least, government monopolies have done. Second possibility, especially, it might have ways of using costs to buy political support. If you think about, say, the postal union and the post office, you can certainly see there's going to be a temptation to deliberately overpay postal workers back when it's a government agency being paid by the dispersed cost of all the people paying for their mail, and those postal workers then, when you're campaigning for office, you being the congressman who helped put in the people running the post office, they'll be willing to work for your campaign, that kind of thing. It's obviously a potential problem. Regulated monopoly is the case where you have a private firm, but then some government regulatory agency, very common for things like electric utilities and such. And the problem with that is if they're forced to charge marginal costs, they'll go broke because, again, they wouldn't cover their fixed costs. So either you would have a subsidy, and, of course, once the subsidy says we'll pay the difference between your revenue and your costs, they've got no incentive to hold down costs anymore. So you'd have to somehow figure out what their costs ought to be in order to decide the subsidy. But more usually what you do is not to subsidize the regulated monopoly, but, again, to allow it to charge what you think is its average cost. This is what's called a rate of return regulation, which basically says the investors are entitled to a market rate of return on their capital, which means you've got to sell the price which just pays all costs, including the cost of your capital. And then the problem is, how do you find out what the real average cost is? Because, again, you can easily enough imagine the firm saying, we will spend lavishly on, you know, nice cars for our executives and fine offices and stuff like that, because, after all, the more we spend, the higher the price we're allowed to charge for our product, and we can then cover it for that way. And yet again, we have the problem, why isn't it the interest of the regulator to actually try to maximize social welfare? Isn't it likely that he can instead tune the regulations for the benefit of the utility in exchange for the understanding that when he retires from being a regulator, he'll have a good job with the utility? Or alternatively, perhaps use his opportunity to expropriate the capital of the regulated industry in order to buy favor with the customers, depending on what the political balance is in any particular case. That is not clear. Again, there's a sense in which what's neat about the market solution is that it's a way in which individual self-interest funnels into doing about what we want to do, and it's not clear we've got a very good mechanism for doing that in political systems, which is a problem. But then, of course, you end up with the alternative of private unregulated monopoly, and that's got the problems that we've just discussed, that the private unregulated monopoly is going to charge prices above what would be economically efficient. And in the case of government-enforced monopoly, of course, it's easy. All you've got to do is have the government not enforce it, but that's politically may not be a viable alternative. One thing I ought to mention, because it's sort of interesting in understanding what happens in the world, is the idea of price discrimination, which is that I've been assuming so far that the monopolist has to sell all of his products at the same price. But a really clever monopolist is going to figure out some way of charging a high price to the customers who really like the product, a low price to the customers who will only buy it at a low price. At that point, he is, in effect, transferring some of the consumer surplus into producer surplus. The logic of that language makes sense? Some of what would have been the gain to the consumer who gets his apples for 50 cents when they're worth $2, why are they 50 cents? Because they got to cut it 50 cents to sell it to other people. If we can figure out a way of selling special organic apples, which are just like all other apples, because of course all food is organic in the literal sense of the term, but if we can get the people who really, you know, are prosperous, they're willing to pay $2 for an organic apple, the poor people will say, well, we don't insist on organic, we'll pay 50 cents. We can now make more money by selling the same apples to hybrid to some people, low price to another. My favorite price discrimination story, doubtless apocryphal, is the optometrist who customer says, how much are these new glasses going to cost? And the optometrist says, $50. And the customer doesn't wince. And the optometrist says, that's for the frame, of course. The lenses are another $40. Customer still doesn't wince each. So that would be price discrimination. And as lawyers, you may very well find yourself engaged in price discrimination. If you're charging a fixed amount per hour, you won't. But if you're in the position of somebody saying, you know, how much will it cost for you to draw up my will, one of the things you might do is to see what kind of car the guy's driving and decide whether you think he's going to be willing to pay a high price or a low price. And there are a bunch of ways in which price discrimination occurs in the market. It is arguable and probably even true that the price difference between hardcovers and paperbacks is at least as much price discrimination as cost of production. That what's going on is the customers who really like the book are willing to pay a higher price for the hardcover, and that price difference, I think, is more than the difference in production cost. I guess one of my favorite examples, I mentioned to this class Bain Books and the way in which they sell books before they're published. No. Bain is a publisher of science fiction and fantasy books, and they were one of the few publishers that saw the internet as an opportunity rather than a threat. And one of the things that Bain does, it's common when a book is published to produce what's called an advance review copy, an ARC, which is basically a copy before the book, the final proofing of the book, so it'll have some errors in it, which is sent out to reviewers in order that when the book actually comes out, the reviewers have already read it and hopefully can give glowing reviews so you can sell copies of your book. Bain, which sells e-books as well as physical books, sells e-advance review copies to customers, not to reviewers. So if you're a fan of some series and you and your friends are waiting to see what happens in the next volume, if you're willing to pay them a little extra, you can get it a month before it's published. If you're going to pay them more extra, you can get it 2 months before it's published. So they're doing price discrimination by, it doesn't cost them any more to give it to you 2 months in advance than 1 month in advance once it's there. But what they're doing is discriminating between the high value and low value customers by how much in advance of the official publication you want to get your advance review copy from, which I think is rather clever. Unfortunately, Jim Bain died a couple of years ago, and it's not clear if the company is going to stay as innovative as it was. I'm prejudiced in favor of them because they published my only novels. So they're obviously good people. At least they were good people. They didn't publish the second one, so maybe they stopped being good people now. Anyway, so similarly, something you sometimes get are one edition of a book for England and one for the U.S., and I don't know if it's still the case, but it certainly used to be the case that some books will say on the cover, it is not legal to sell this book in country X. And what's probably going on there, is that the richer country, they are charging a higher price, the poorer country a lower price, and that's again a form of price discrimination. The actual effect from the standpoint of economic efficiency of price discrimination is complicated, and I don't think I'm going to try to go into it at the moment, except to say that it has both advantages and disadvantages. On the one hand, if the monopolist engages in price discrimination, to some extent, he's solving the problem of the consumer who values the good a little bit above marginal cost. Because if the producer can manage it, he'll identify that customer and sell it to him a little above marginal cost. Right? So that's an advantage. But on the other hand, you want the good available at the same price to everybody so that everybody who values it at more than the price gets it and less than the price doesn't. Whereas with price discrimination, if you happen to be a poor American and the book is sold for $15 in the U.S. and $10 in England, you could have a situation where the American who values it at $14 doesn't get it. The Englishman who values it at $13 does get it. That's an inefficient allocation in the sense the good is not going to be able to value it most. So that would be a long discussion. All I'm saying is price discrimination sounds like a bad thing because we've got this bizarre idea that discrimination is a negative term, although, you know, in lots of contexts it isn't. And we like people to be discriminating in their tastes in food, for example, with tastes in friends. But price discrimination, economically speaking, is interesting because it can often explain actual observed patterns of behavior, such as I've just described, good in some ways, bad in other ways. On the whole, people who are egalitarians should probably like price discrimination because one of the things that makes people willing to pay higher prices is being rich, and price discrimination, if it's done well, tends to offer lower prices to poor people than to rich people. All right, let me now go on to one of the most important problems with the simple model of why the market works and with some of the ways of dealing with it, which we'll be getting to more probably next week. And that problem is what economists call externalities. Let us suppose that I am producing steel. And to produce steel, I need the labor of steel workers. To get that, I got to pay them enough so they'd rather produce steel for me than anything else they could do. I need some capital to build my factory, and to get that, I've got to pay investors enough so they'd rather lend me the money than lend anybody else the money. So forth for a long list of costs. So all of those costs go into the cost of what I'm producing. But there's one other cost, and that is that when I produce steel, I put out sulfur dioxide, which blows downwind and makes it unpleasant for 1,000 people living downwind from my factory. And if we're imagining a world where there are no special laws covering that kind of thing, it might nowadays covered might be under EPA regulations, traditionally under law of nuisance perhaps, but supposing there are no such rules to start with, I'm going to ignore that cost. So therefore, if steel is a competitive industry, it's going to sell too cheaply. It's going to sell at a cost that includes the cost of the labor and the cost of the capital and the cost of the inputs, but doesn't include the cost of the pollution, the cost imposed by the pollution. All right. And in fact, there are going to be two inefficiencies. The first inefficiency is the steel will be too cheap, because meaning that people will use steel instead of aluminum, supposing aluminum doesn't have externalities, even if aluminum is really cheaper, because one of the costs for steel is not showing up in the price. Right? If you think of the prices as a signaling system, just as monopoly has the effect of signaling too high a cost for something, so negative externalities like pollution result in your signaling too low a cost. Yep.
So I'm having a difficult time discerning definition of externality.
It is a cost or benefit. There are negative and positive externalities that your action imposes on other people which doesn't require their consent. That's probably the closest I can come to give you an exact definition. And it's tricky because to some extent the fact that something is externality is sort of a fact of physics, and to some extent it's a fact of the law. That if you, for example, suppose we had slavery. Suppose some institution within the country was allowed to draft people to work at wages that it set. Which, of course, they are. It's called juries. Used to be the army as well. In that case, when a court decides to have a trial, its estimate of the costs of the trial don't include the cost to the juror who is being paid less than he could get doing something else, but is being compelled to do it. So that's a case where making people work is an externality because of the particular legal rule that says you don't need their consent. The more normal case is the one where it would at least be hard to do it as ordinary property. So that if we say, for example, that I can't pollute your air without your permission, if there are 1,000 people downwind, even if the cost of preventing the pollution is much more, suppose that the stink is only occasional, isn't very serious, on a property rule, I'd have to get unanimous consent of all of those people, right? Just like I've got a unanimous consent of everybody who works for me. But unlike working, in the working, if you refuse to work for me, I hire him instead. If you refuse to give me permission, you happen to be living downwind, I can't buy permission for her instead because I'm polluting your air as well. So the fact that something's externality is in part a statement about what the legal rules are and in part a statement about how difficult it is to use market transaction mechanisms to handle it. To take a different example, and sort of an interesting real-world one, you can think of radio broadcast as a positive externality. All right, we usually call them a public good in economics, but the ideas sort of blend into each other. So that when you put on a radio program, what's happening, you are providing a benefit for everybody within broadcast range. You can't do that as an ordinary sale because it isn't practical for you to go to each person and say, unless you pay me, you can't listen. But it's not impossible. You could certainly imagine a system where it was illegal for you to listen to my broadcast unless you paid the licensing fee. And where people snuck around listening, you know, every once in a while they put in a beep on my broadcast and they would listen for those beeps and see if any of them were coming from locations that hadn't paid for licenses. And in fact, England does do it that way, or at least used to. I think they still do with regard to their public broadcasting system. You have to pay for a license and it's illegal to listen without having paid for the license. How well they enforce it, I don't know. So the point I'm really making is that economists often talk as though the fact that something was externality was simply a given, a you know, sort of fact of reality. And that's really, there's some truth to it, but it's an exaggeration. So that a better way of putting it is that there are some things where it is very hard to reflect the cost via market transactions, and others where it's easy. Where it's very hard, you probably don't, and if you don't, you have an externality. Does that make sense? Yeah. All right. So then the second problem with my air pollution case is that not only am I selling steel too cheaply, I'm also making it wrong. Because at some cost, I could reduce that pollution. And the economically efficient rule would be, if I can eliminate the pollution at a cost to me that's less than the cost of people downwind of having the pollution, I ought to do it. All right? That would be economically efficient. Net benefit. Gain to them larger than cost to me. But as long as I'm not liable for the pollution, I get no benefit from eliminating it unless I happen to live downwind, which I prudently don't. And therefore, I have no incentive to put in the pollution control. And calling it pollution sounds like it answers the question. It's one of these loaded terms. It, you know, if you say, what's the optimal amount of pollution? The temptation is to say, obviously, no pollution. But that's, of course, wrong because preventing pollution is costly. For example, many people now believe that carbon dioxide is a pollutant because of global warming. Well, if all of us stop producing that, in about 5 minutes, we'll be dead. Because human beings exhale carbon dioxide, inhale oxygen, a necessary part of human life. So the optimal amount of that kind of pollution is surely greater than zero. And less obviously, if the sulfur dioxide for the steel, if making steel is very valuable to people, and if the only ways of preventing steel from producing sulfur dioxide are very, very expensive, the optimal thing might be to have a certain amount of sulfur dioxide coming out from the steel. So the right rule from the economist standpoint is basically you should control pollution whenever the cost of controlling is less than the damage done. Let it exist whenever the cost of controlling it is more than the damage done. That's sort of generalization of the general idea that you produce things when they're worth, when the cost of producing them is less than the value to somebody and not when it's more. And so the problem is not that pollution is a cost. The problem is that pollution is a cost that's getting left out of the normal market calculations of what to do. And there are a number of possible solutions. Again, sort of the obvious solution is the central one. The obvious solution is to have a regulator who says this steel mill has to put up high smokestacks so as to reduce the cost of the pollution. Or this power plant has got to have scrubbers to take the sulfur out of the the smokes that comes up. And there are some fairly obvious problems with that, which should be obvious by now. One of them is that to do it right, the regulator needs information he probably doesn't have, because he needs to know not only how much damage the sulfur coming out of the smokestack does, but what are the costs of all of the alternative ways of producing it. And, of course, one way of reducing it might be to move your factory someplace where nobody lives and sulfur dioxide isn't bothering anyone. Another way might be to buy low-sulfur coal instead of high-sulfur coal. More expensive, but produces less sulfur dioxide. A lot of different ways. And the especially if you're thinking not about a single power plant or a single steel mill, but about, you know, thousands of these things spread across the country, it's hard to see how the regulator would have the necessary expertise to do it. And then there's a second problem I keep alluding to. Even if they could, why would they find it in their interest to? That the regulator will do whatever is basically politically profitable. There's no particular reason to think it would be politically profitable to do that. And my favorite real-world example, which has to do, in fact, with scrubbing smokestacks, was that at one point, I guess it was the EPA, made rules for power plants, and the rules were that, roughly speaking, that they had to remove a certain percentage of the sulfur from the smoke coming up the smokestack by scrubbing. Why was this a foolish rule? Because it eliminates the advantage of using low-sulfur coal. It means if you use low-sulfur coal, produce a little sulfur, you've got to take out 90% of that. High-sulfur coal, a lot of sulfur, got to take out 90% of that. All right? So you don't have the incentive. Why did they do it? Pretty clearly, because there were senators from states that produced high-sulfur coal, and they didn't want regulations that would wipe out or very largely decrease the demand for the coal their states produced. So that would be sort of one example of the potential problems with that solution. There's another solution that economists like much better, although it also has some problems, and the sort of latest thinking, or the latest thinking in this case by this point is almost 50 years old, is that there are problems with it. There are logical problems with it, but it may still make sense. And this is a solution proposed by a guy called Pigou, an economist back in the 1930s. And his solution is to say that instead of using regulation to tell you what you can do, we just set a price. So if the regulatory agency can figure out how much damage the sulfur dioxide does, which itself is a problem, but it has to do that to regulate anyway, instead of saying to the steel mill, this is how you must control your sulfur dioxide, they say, produce as much sulfur dioxide as you like, we'll send you a bill every year. We've decided that every ton of sulfur dioxide does $1,000 worth of damage. We will measure your effluent at your smokestack, maybe randomly monitor or something, and charge you $1,000 per ton of sulfur dioxide. Now, it's up to you. If you really can't reduce it, well, pay us. But on the other hand, it's now in your interest, if you can find any way of reducing that emission that costs less than $1,000 per ton to reduce, it is in your private selfish interest to do it, and you're much more confident to figure out how to reduce sulfur dioxide than we are, since you're running your particular power plant, steel mill or whatever. So that's the Pigouvian solution, what's called an effluent fee. The version current politically popular is called cap and trade, and we could discuss if people are interested, but it really turns out to be a mildly different version of the same approach, because with cap and trade, you have a fixed amount of sulfur dioxide that all the power plants are allowed to emit. Each power plant has a limited allocation of how much of it can emit, and they can trade those allocations. So then the price you've got to pay for permission to produce an extra ton of sulfur dioxide is analogous to the Pigouvian tax, to the fee you would be charged for producing this. The difference is that cap and trade, the revenue is going from one power plant to another, whereas the tax version of the revenue is going from the power plants to the government. And the advantage of cap and trade, politically speaking, is that it results in largely eliminating opposition to the program from the industry that you're imposing it on. And in fact, you can even set up situations where the industry profits go up with cap and trade as a result of the fact that raising marginal cost of production means that prices go up. And since you're not, on average, you're not paying for the permits you've already gotten allocated, and yet you're selling those at a price which includes the cost of the cost per ton of each extra ton permit, depending on how the numbers work out, what looks like a regulation controlling the industry might increase industry profits, which is a great thing if you're a senator who wants to pass the regulation, and you want to make sure the industry lobbies for it instead of against it. Anyway, so that's a sort of standard, popular with economists solution. And the latest version of this, I say latest is in the 1960s, is due to a man called Ronald Coase. And there's a story that goes with this. And the story is that at the time, Coase comes to Chicago to give a talk on his ideas on externalities, essentially. And this is at a time when essentially all economists have been convinced a long time ago by Pigou that the right way to handle externality problems is to impose Pigouvian taxes, to charge the polluter for his effluent. Notice, by the way, that one further advantage of charging him for the effluent over just telling him what to do is that now the price of steel is right. If you just tell them what to do, then the price of steel includes the cost of controlling pollution, but it doesn't include the cost of whatever amount of pollution the regulators decide they've got to allow. Does that make sense? Suppose we go back to the regulatory solution. The EPA tells the power plant, you've got to scrub out a certain amount of sulfur. The power plant, in deciding what price it's willing to sell power, I'm going to assume power is a competitive industry, I don't know if it's true, but for our present analysis, suppose it is. In that case, the power plant says, what is our cost of producing power? It includes the cost of those scrubbers. It doesn't include the cost of the sulfur dioxide that's still getting past the scrubbers, because the regular agency isn't making us eliminate all pollution. That would cost far too much. So it's still the case that power or steel, whatever, is being underpriced in terms of the real cost of producing it, even though not by as much as before. The Pigouvian tax, we both have the cost of whatever we do to hold down our pollution and the cost and the tax we have to pay of pollution we still produce, and therefore we get the right price. This assumes, of course, that whoever is imposing the tax really knows how much damage the pollution does. That's a further problem. And it assumes they choose to charge right, because, again, we're going to have the political problems of how you get political actors to do the right thing. So the story is that Coase comes to Chicago, and before giving his talk at Chicago, he has dinner at the house of Aaron Director, who was the first editor of the Journal of Law and Economics. And I think at that dinner there were present about 14 or 15 of the Chicago economists, of whom at least three, counting Coase, and maybe more than three, eventually get Nobel Prizes. At the beginning of the dinner, the argument is 13-1 against Coase. That is, everybody else thinks Pigou is right. Coase says, no, Pigou is wrong, and here's why. End of the dinner is 14-0 for Coase. End of the evening, it's 14-0 for Coase. So that's sort of one of the stories economists like, because it's one of the few cases where you really have a conflict of ideas when somebody wins. And Coase's argument goes roughly as follows. To begin with, Coase says, you've misunderstood the problem when you call it an externality, when you call it a cost I impose on you. Because it's certainly true that there'd be no problem if I weren't pumping sulfur dioxide out of my smokestacks, but there would also be no problem if you weren't choosing to live downwind from me. So that really the cost is being produced by a joint decision of the two of us to do incompatible things. You might say, well, yeah, but that's just sort of a quibble, but it isn't a quibble. Because suppose we consider the question of airport noise. All right, airplanes are noisy coming down. And if there are people living under the flight path, you have a real problem that either the people are woken up every time an airplane comes down, or the airplanes have to come in very high, which is costly and maybe dangerous, and have to do various expensive things to reduce sound. Externality. But it's not at all clear whether the right solution to that problem is to have the airlines make less noise, or to have the flight path occupied by wheat fields, which aren't bothered by noise, instead of by residential housing. All right? And if you certainly imagine, we have some prejudice towards first movers. So imagine the airline is already there, and there are wheat fields. And then a developer comes in, builds a lovely development right under the flight path, and then sues the airlines to tell them you've got to stop making noise. At that point, it becomes much less clear to our intuitions whose fault it is. And you can think of a lot of other examples. If you imagine that I've got some perfectly ordinary activity, I've got noisy children, and everything is fine until my neighbor says, by the way, I think I ought to tell you that I've set up a recording studio in my house right across the property line from your house, and the amount of noise your kids make, it's just too much. I can't do my professional recording with that amount of background noise, so you're going to have to shut up your kids. Or you can pay me damages if you like. Maybe I'll sue you. All right. So cases like that emphasize the fact that we're really talking about cases, situations, where a cost is produced by decisions made by two different people. it could be eliminated typically by either of them, or sometimes by things done by both of them. And the Pigouvian way of looking at it takes it for granted that you already know sort of who was at fault or who was imposing the cost or who should control it. And if you imagine that we have the... So take my airline, my airline case. Suppose it's the case that once the housing development goes in, the Pigouvian tax on the airline will be high enough so they will stop making noise in some fashion or in some very expensive fashion. Well, there's no reason I shouldn't build that housing development there, should I? Even though, almost certainly in my imaginary case, the much cheaper solution to the problem would be for me to build my housing development somewhere else and let the airplanes keep making noise. Right. So the first step of Coase's argument is what I usually describe as nothing works. That if you decide that we will think of the airline as liable, that gives the wrong result if the person who can most cheaply solve the problem is the housing developer. If you decide the housing developer is at fault and has no claim against the airlines, that gives you the wrong result if it turns out that indeed that's the best use for the land and the cheapest solution is to have the planes be quieter. And more generally, if you have a problem caused by the joint decision of two people, any sort of mechanical way of saying, well, you've got to solve it, Coase says, might pick the wrong person, in which case you would make things worse rather than better. Right? So that's sort of the first step of the story. Second step of Coase's statement, this is the nothing works. Second one is what I think of as everything works. Coase says, wait a minute, we've forgotten about bargaining, we've forgotten about transactions. If the rule says that the housing developer has the right to silence, then of course the sensible airlines are going to buy all the land that's under the flight path before the airport is built up. They will rent it out to people who will use it for wheat, not for housing. Solves the problem. Think of other cases. Coase discusses a real English, I think, 19th century case where there was a candy factory which had machinery that vibrated the walls and stuff and wasn't the problem before, but then a physician next door builds a consulting room right next to the property line, right against the candy factory, and then complains he can't hear his stethoscope because of the vibration, and he sues to shut down the candy factory. And Coase says, well, look, if the law says he can shut down the candy factory, but if shutting down the candy factory is much more expensive than moving his consulting room to the other side of the house, the candy factory guy will make a deal with the physician saying, look, I'll pay you the cost of moving your consulting room and a little extra for sweetener. Efficient result gotten. And that generalizes into what I think Stigler called the Coase theorem, which is that in a world of zero transaction costs, in a world where any time that there's a transaction that benefits people is possible it happens, then in that world, any initial definition of property rights will work, because whatever the initial definition is, the parties will always bargain to the efficient outcome. Because any time there's a change which benefits you more than it hurts me, we can make a deal in which you pay me a bit more than the hurt and a bit less than the benefit, and I agree to the deal. Right? So the second step of Coase's argument is everything works provided there are no transaction costs. And then the third step is to realize that it all depends on transaction costs. So if we try to apply this to my sulfur dioxide and steel mill case, imagine the law says that there's no liability for putting out sulfur dioxide, and there's one steel mill and 1,000 people downwind. Well, in a world of zero transaction costs, the 1,000 people get together and they say, well, look, all together it's worth $10 million to us to have clean air. It'll only cost $5 million to get the steel mill to put in filters that'll get out the sulfur dioxide. We'll make a deal with them. Problem solved. That's the Coase theorem solution. But it's not going to work because there are 1,000 of them. And each of the homeowners will correctly say, if the other homeowners put up almost $10 million, or put up $5 million, whatever it's going to take, I'll get clean air for nothing. And with 10,000 homeowners, it is very, very unlikely that my 1,000th of the contribution will make the difference between getting it or not getting it. This is what we economists call the public good problem. The problem where you're producing something where, if produced at all the members of a pre-existing group of people get it. And the larger the public, generally, the harder it is to produce such a good. It's exactly the same reason why the people injured by the auto tariff can't outbid the auto companies. Because people injured by the tariff are roughly 290 million people, And even though their total injury is larger than the total benefit to the auto companies and other people who have benefited, 290 people, if they stop the auto tariff, they'll all get the benefit of cheaper cars. And each person will correctly say, why should I chip in anything when I'm not going to make the difference? Right? That's the public good problem. So the sort of final step in Coase's argument is to say the real reason you get inefficient outcomes is not because you have externalities, it's because you have transaction costs. It's because the externality that could be solved by an appropriate bargain among the parties is not so solved because the difficulties of organizing the transaction that would do it, such as getting 1,000 homeowners to each chip in $6,000 a piece to make a $6 million offer to purify the air, are not going to happen. All right. So that's a very brief summary. If any of you take my law and econ class, which unless, I guess there are no first-year students here, so unless you're part-time people taking more than 3 years, you can't take my law and econ class because I teach it every other year and I'm teaching it this year. But if you're curious enough, my book is up on the web for free. You can read it there. Anyway, in that, Coase's analysis of externalities turns out to be one central element to understanding the law, if you think about ways in which legal rules try to deal with these problems. All right, so if you now think about externalities and the law, one solution to the externality problem, as we've already discussed, is EPA-style regulation, in which the EPA tells the power plant or the steel mill, this is what you have to do to control externalities. Another solution is Pigouvian taxes, and one of the things that comes out of this is realizing that one way of looking at tort law is it's a system of Pigouvian taxes. Because what's the basic rule in tort of what the amount of damage is? When I am found to be a tortfeasor who have imposed costs on you, what does tort law require me to do? You should all know the answer to this. It's sort of kindergarten law. What does a tortfeasor have to do when he's lost the case? That's right. Make the victim whole. Well, Pigou says that's great. What's he saying? He's saying that they owe a damage equal to the amount of damage done by their act. So if my tort was driving carelessly and I damaged your car, I've got to pay for fixing the car. That means that in deciding how carefully to drive, I will include the cost of costs I impose on other people by denting them in my decision of whether it's worth driving more carefully or driving less often or getting better brakes or whatever it is. Therefore, the externality has been internalized. Therefore, what before would have been an external cost is now a private cost to me and goes into my calculation of what to do. That's one way of looking at tort law. It's an imperfect way for lots of reasons we could go into, but at least it does give an economic picture in which tort law seems to make sense. And one can even think of criminal law in those terms. The part of the difference is that criminal law, we expect we catch and convict only a fraction of criminals, so we have a punishment which scales up in theory to allow for to balance the less than certain probability of paying it. And you can again analyze criminal law from that statement. Similarly, as I was saying, air pollution, the cap-and-trade approach to carbon dioxide emissions is really equivalent to Pigouvian tax because it ends up that if you want to produce a certain amount of carbon dioxide, you have to buy permits for producing that amount from someone else in the business, or alternatively, if you've got the permits, if you didn't produce the carbon dioxide, you could sell them. So the cost of the carbon dioxide to you is really the cost of the permits it requires, whether you're buying or selling. Does that make sense? In one case, you're using up a valuable asset that you could have sold. In the other case, you've got to buy the asset. So logically speaking, a cap and trade is really a variant on the Pigouvian tax. And the two significant differences are, first, that instead of the tax money going to the government, the tax money, in effect, is going back to the industry. But it's going to the industry as an average, not a marginal. That is to say, producing more carbon dioxide doesn't get me more permits, but it means I need more permits. So while it's true, in effect, that my first 1,000 units of carbon dioxide are free because I got those permits, what determines how much I produce is how much one more thing is going to cost me, and that's going to be costly. And the other difference is that a Pigouvian tax really requires you to estimate the amount of damage done by each additional unit of the pollution. A cap and trade system requires you to estimate what total amount of pollution you want, because that's what you set your number of permits at. So if you imagine some form of pollution, where how much damage varies a lot with it, but it's pretty clear that more than 1,000 units you have really bad consequences, and less than 900 doesn't really matter. You have a case like that. Well, you set your cap and trade at 900, you're home free. You don't have to know how much damage is actually being done by extra unit. Whereas if you have one where you say however much you produce, each extra unit is going to do $3 worth of damage. Set up a Pigouvian tax of $3. So that's sort of... But as I said, they're really basically the same. In a general sense, they're the same. They're the same mechanism, different variants of it. Let me go on briefly to talk about public goods, which I mentioned a few minutes before. And that is, again, a public good. Public goods are one of the many problems where the fact that technical terms are written in English makes people think they understand them when they don't. So a public good sounds like a good produced by government, but in fact lots of public goods are produced privately and lots of private goods are produced by government. That a public good is a good... There are two characteristics that go into the definition. I think one of them is essential and one isn't. But the one that I think is essential is non-excludability. The one that's essential is the producer can't control who gets it. So if I make a radio broadcast, it's not available to the world, but it's available to everybody within 400 miles of my antenna. And I can't say, well, you paid and you get it. You didn't pay, you didn't get it. The usual other half of the definition is that it's non-crowdable, meaning that the cost to me doesn't depend on how many people are listening to the radio station. So in that sense, one more person listening does not increase the cost to me. And those are the usual definitions of it. Non-rival, that's sometimes called. And the public good problem is, how do you pay for the cost of producing a public good? Because ordinary private goods, you pay from the cost by saying to the customer, if you don't pay, you don't get it. Public good, if there are three customers, I can probably do that. I can say to the three people, work it out among yourselves how you're going to raise the $6,000 which is going to cost. When you're finished, offer me the money and I'll produce your public good. But for 1,000 or 100,000 or 100 million people, it's really hard to do that. All right? So, what are the possible solutions to the public good problem? There are some private solutions. After all, I've just proved that radio broadcasts don't exist, and yet they do. Television broadcasts as well. And the answer is that some unsung genius thought up the idea of producing not one public good, but two. One of them is a public good with a positive cost of production and a positive value to the consumer that we call a radio program. And one of them is a public good with a negative cost of production and a negative value to the consumer that we call an advertisement. And you tie the two tightly together and give away the package. Do you see why I say that an advertisement has a negative cost of production? Because companies will pay my radio station to put on an ad. So from my standpoint, it's money in, not money out. So that's sort of one ingenious solution. But there are a lot of other solutions. If the public is small, you can imagine doing it by unanimous contract. So that I imagine I want to build a flood control dam and there are 10 farmers downstream. And so I go to the 10 farmers and say, look, in order for it to pay me to build this dam, each of you has to chip in $10,000. Here is a contract. The contract says, I, the undersigned, agree to pay $10,000 towards the flood dam, conditional on the other 9 people on the list signing the contract. So now each person will say to himself, if anyone doesn't sign, it doesn't matter if I sign. Contract can be null. If the other 9 people sign, my signing costs me $10,000 against a flood control dam that's worth more than $10,000 to me, therefore I should sign. So that's one way of getting a public good, but it's one way that gets harder and harder as the number goes up, if you think about sort of practical difficulties of arranging some of that. And then there are a variety of other ways. One very common way is that you have what's called a privileged minority, which is a somewhat bizarre term because their privilege is to pay for what other people get. So, for example, let's think about my mowing my lawn or planting pretty flowers in my yard or painting my house. All of those are a public good in as much as they make that neighborhood prettier for people who drive past, for my neighbors who can see my lawn, can see my house, and so forth. How do we provide that public good? Well, this neighbor gets $10 and that neighbor gets $15 and that one gets $17 and I get $6,000 worth of value, not money. That is to say, the benefit to me, I get a much larger share of the benefit than any of the others, and it's large enough so that even though I don't collect the whole benefit, I'm willing to pay the whole price. And you can think of quite a lot of cases where that's happening, where in effect there is some subgroup of the public which is small enough so that it can get together and agree to make the payment and gets a large enough benefit so it's willing to fund the whole public good and everybody else free rides on it. And that's one solution to how you manage it. And then, of course, another solution is to use either law or technology to make something from a public good to a private good. So, for example, a radio broadcast is a public good, but cable TV is a private good because you've now changed the technology delivering in such a way you can control who gets it. And you can think of a lot of variants of that. And there are other variants which are sort of analogous to the advertisement, which involve tie-ins of one sort or another. If you think about the fact that on the web, it largely is by advertisement, but not entirely, that I give away a bunch of books on my website. Got a number of reasons to do that, but one of the reasons is it gets me speaking engagements, which I get paid for. So on the web, it's much easier to give away information than to sell it. So in that sense, putting something up on my webpage is producing a public good. And one reason you're willing to do so is you can find ways that in producing that public good, you produce a private good. To take a different example, which is intellectual property, of course, if you think about it, IP, it involves a whole lot of public good problems, namely that I make an invention, other people can benefit by it. Patent law tries to turn that into a private good by requiring licensing. But another private solution is when the Macintosh computer came out, it came with two programs called McWrite and McPaint, which were at the time very innovative programs. McWrite was one of the early word processors. And they were free. And you could make all the copies you liked. There was only one problem with making copies of those programs. What do you think was the reason that Apple was willing to give away those programs? You could only put it on a Macintosh, right? So you could get the programs for free, but you had to buy the Macintosh. So another way of doing the public good is to find, for certain particular public goods, is to have a tie-in where giving away this increases the value of that you can sell. You could discuss other things. My basic point is that it's not as simple as public goods can't be produced privately. It's rather we expect public goods to be underproduced privately. Sometimes that means not produced at all. Sometimes it only means that it would be optimal to produce a larger quantity or a higher quality than you do. All right. And then the obvious alternative is government production of public goods. And for economists, at least, externalities and public good problems are one of the main arguments for why government exists. National defense, the book makes the assertion that without government there will be no privately supplied national defense. That's an overstatement. My favorite counterexample, that is the Comanche Indians. The Comanche were anarchists. They had nothing we would recognize as a government. They blocked expansion of white settlers across Texas for something like 20 years, despite smaller population and lower technology, because they were really good at fighting, and they really liked fighting, and they got a lot of status from fighting, and they got loot from fighting, and so that was a case where you actually had their version of national defense was privately produced. And you could imagine cases of that in the modern society, but there are clearly really serious problems, because national defense is very much a public good, because I defend the country, I'm defending you and you, even if you don't help defend the country. All right? So that would be an argument for national defense. And as usual, the problems with public production of public goods are first that even with the best will in the world, it's hard to do it right, because how do you get the necessary information? How do you find out how much your government-produced television program is worth to the consumers? How do you find out what they want, how much you should spend, what kind of programming you should do, all sorts of things of that sort, and ditto for any other public good, that unlike ordinary private goods on the market, you don't have the feedback of, I can sell this to this many people at this price and that to that many people at that price, telling you what people value. You could ask people, of course, but if you ask somebody, it's in my interest to say I greatly value whatever I like, much, much more than I really value, because I'm not going to pay for it. That way you'll produce it for me. So that's not a very effective way. And then there's, as usual, the second problem that I keep referring to, that we don't really have a good way of making the government actors make the decision, having it in their private interest to make the right decisions. That they can think of lots of ways in which, I guess the sort of classic example for medical insurance is that the state law requires medical insurance to cover characteristics A, B, and C, whether the customers want that or not. Why? Because the providers of A, B, and C lobbied whoever was making the laws to include what they provided and what was covered. So that you may have a case where you have to get insured against pregnancy, even if you have no intention of getting pregnant, where you have to get insured for the cost of a psychiatrist, even if you don't believe in psychiatrists, and presumably that reflects lobbying by those particular groups. Alright, so I think I'm running out of time, but it should be clear to you at this point why the public good problem is an argument against government as well as for government. It's an argument for government because it means that certain kinds of things we can't expect to get produced, or at least produced at the right level, on the private market. It's an argument against government because getting government to work is itself a public good problem. Because for the individual voter, if the individual voter figures out whether his legislator is acting like a philosopher king, is acting in the interest of the country, and then votes accordingly, he will be, any benefit from the effort and time he spends figuring out how to vote is going to be shared among the whole population, so that's a public good, and it's hard to get people to privately produce public goods for 300 million people, which is what you're doing. So public good problem is simultaneously a reason why it would be a nice thing to have governments do certain things, and a reason why you can't count on the government to do things that it's a nice thing to do. And that's sort of the paradox in an odd kind of sense. And we're out of time.